Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, August 15, 2019. A close associate of South Sudan's first vice president quits his camp.
If they think I cannot perform, I could do it on the other side. Unfortunately, when I went to SPLM Ayo-Taban, that was not taken serious by the government in Juba. And I'm sure Taban is ashamed of that now.
And South Sudan waives visa requirements to citizens of Tanzania.
If there was anything that need an urgent operationalization, it could have been entry and free entry either to Kenya or to Uganda before the Tanzania come. If you look at the major population of South Sudanese who are displaced, majority are in Uganda, majority are in Kenya.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A close associate of South Sudan's first vice president, Taban Dengai, has defected to join rebel leader Riek Machar. Joseph Madak Bothwell says his 7 months of working with Taban was, quote, a waste of time, end of quote. Wall says the SPLM IO under Riek Machar has what he calls a vision for the people of South Sudan, and he says he regrets that he joined first Vice President Taban Dengai back in 2017.
The reason I decided to join him was primarily to contribute in implementations of the agreement. That was one reason. And again, from the other side, why I left the SPLM IO by then in January 2017, I had issues and concerns of leadership in the SPLM IO with respect to management and administrations of the cause for which the movement was established in Nasser Declarations, which is in a consultative conference in Nasser in April 2014. In Nasser.
You are telling me you left the main SPLM IO in 2017 because you disagreed with the leadership and you joined Taban Dengai. And now you're going back to the same SPLM that you left because of leadership problems. Is there any changes within the SPLM IO now that you're going back to join?
I primarily agree with you. After having been in Juba for 7 months, I have found out that the SPLM IO continue to remain as the only vehicle for making changes and transforming our country to a good democratic governance where we can have a rule of law and we can ensure economic and social transformation in our country.
Joseph Wall, allow me to ask you a question that ordinary South Sudanese would ask. You have been jumping from one camp to another in the same party within the period of 2 years. You were with Riek Machar, you went to Taban Dengai, you are going back to Riek Machar now. What is the guarantee that you will remain with Riek Machar, given your political history of jumping from one camp to another?
John Tanza, you may very well know that in the political context, as somebody who has been a minister in the government of the then Sudan in 1997 until 2001, and later became a policy expert in the office of the president from 2009. Until we had our independence in 2011, one have acquired a substantial knowledge and experience in politics where you see where your interest lies.
Given this explanation you're telling me now that your interest has not been fulfilled, now are you in politics because of your interest or the interest of South Sudanese?
This is a very good question. That's a very good question, John. My interest as a political leader primarily is the interest of the people. When you go as a politician, what you pursue the interest of your people in the person of yourself. It is not that people pursue their interests individually or by
themselves. Suppose President Salva Kiir replied to the request from the first vice president to install you back in your senior position. Would you leave Juba?
what would have happened, would be that it would give me an opportunity now to exert my efforts to ensure that the grassroots consultations and the mobilizations and sensitization of our peace, which is my main objective for implementation of the agreement, for it to work, would have been given an opportunity. And if that didn't work for reasons that everybody continue to be concerned about, surely at the end of the day, I will pull out, because my interest is to see peace, to see prosperity, to see economic prosperity, see our people returns back from the camps and go back to their own homes.
Yes, Joseph, it's well said, and it sounds really great that you have the interests of the people in your heart. But at the same time, your movement from one faction of the same party to another gives a signal that you are looking for a greener pasture, so to speak.
John, I think that would be a misrepresentation of the fact. As I said earlier, as a political leader, I have the responsibility to explore and search what works for my people. I'm not supposed to be sitting, sticking on a desk where the interests of my people are not served in the person of myself. I have the capacities, I have the abilities, I have the experience. It should be exploited for the interests of the people. Moving from one point to another, this is a genuine approach and a strategic approach, John.
And how would you respond to people who would say the government of national unity is about to be formed in November 12th, and the game now is for people to change their alliances so that they align themselves with a team that will give them what they want?
I would tell them they should not really use one stick to measure or maybe to level or consider each and every political leader on that aspect. Let them have a clear understanding that leaders are different. I'm different from other leaders.
Yes, you are different because you're moving from one camp to another. No politician moves from three different factions of a party within a short period. That's your difference.
I have moved in in a fraction of 2 years. I've given the SPLM-IO from 2013 until 2017. You can see that time frame where I have been in SPLM-IO and I have not been properly neutralized, and it's not going to serve the interests of the people, because I'm expected by my people to play that vital role, to be at the front line and seek peace for our people. Again, that's the reason I said, if they think I cannot perform, I could do it on the other side. Unfortunately, when I went to SPLM-IO Taban, that was not taken serious by the government in Juba. And I'm sure Taban is ashamed of that now.
That was Joseph Madak Bothwell, a former close associate of South Sudan's first vice president, Taban Dengai. He was speaking to me from Toronto, Canada, this past hour. The South Sudan government has waived visa requirements for citizens of Tanzania intending to enter South Sudan. An analyst and civil society activist says the move is long overdue, but a professor of economic studies and political science at the University of Juba says the parliament should have approved the decision before it was implemented. Wake Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
University of Juba professor Abraham Kualinyuan says the move to grant Tanzanians free visas simply reciprocates a move Tanzania did for South Sudan some time ago and follows the protocol of the East African Community, which grants free movement to citizens of member states.
Even if the IGP and the Minister of Interior and the Director General of Immigration and Passport were supposed to make the decision, they were supposed to wait for the approval of the parliament, which is the supreme body in charge of all legal protocol and statutes that need to be rectified and approved by the South Sudan for that thing to be operationalized. So to me, it is not yet official unless it is operationalized by the parliament.
Wani Michael, executive director of the civil society organization OK Africa Foundation, agrees.
This is within the framework of East Africa, where you're supposed to have free movement of citizens or people within East Africa community. Because now the practice is that when you go to Tanzania, you don't pay visa or you don't pay any visa fee in Tanzania.
In a communique released late last month by the Director of Immigration at the Ministry of Interior, Major General Nyangti Chotedak, orders the ministry to grant free visas to all Tanzanian citizens. South Sudan in Focus sought comment from the Director of Immigration, but the Director General at the South Sudan Ministry of Interior rejected the interview request. Kual says South Sudan should take the same action for Kenya and Uganda.
If there was anything that need an urgent operationalization, it could have been entry and free entry either to Kenya or to Uganda before the Tanzania come. If you look at the major population of South Sudanese who are displaced, majority are in Uganda, majority are in Kenya. We have almost nil in Tanzania.
Michael Dunn plays arguments by some South Sudanese that the move will rob them of their jobs as Tanzanians with expertise in certain technical fields will flock to South Sudan.
There are specific protocol within the East Africa community on how people are supposed to get a job. So the thinking that when you have Tanzanians and Rwandans come to Juba or South Sudan, they're going to get our jobs is not true.
But Kual says the South Sudan government must regulate how foreigners are allowed to work in the country.
The government is supposed also to come up with another policy of regulating the issues of doing the work and issuing the work permit so that it is not a matter of entering to South Sudan, but what are you coming to do into South Sudan, which need also to be investigated before maybe stemming the entry into South Sudan.
Besides Tanzania, South Sudanese can also enter Rwanda without paying for a visa. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Lilongwe, where a court in Malawi this week sentenced three people to death for killing albino. The sentence came after the court found them guilty of gruesome murder in which they removed the arms and legs of a victim in 2015 in the belief that the body parts are magical. As Lamik Masina reports, not everyone believes the death penalty will be an effective deterrent.
Malawi's courts have long been accused of giving lenient sentences to people who attack albinos, a development believed to contribute to the persistence of the attacks. In a report released in May, Amnesty International said that 22 albinos have been murdered in Malawi since 2014. Judge Esme Chombo, who issued the death sentence on Tuesday, said the penalty will act as a strong deterrent to others and help stop the attacks. Mark Bottoman is the government spokesperson. He told VOA the government is pleased with the court verdict.
We are glad that something is being done, and we're very grateful to judiciary that they're moving towards this direction. We hope the kind of punishments that have been meted by the courts will be able to deter those that have evil motives, to attack or abduct or kill people with albinism.
However, Edgar Nyongolo, a constitutional lawyer at Chancellor College of the University of Malawi, believes that death sentences cannot deter attacks if cases take a long time to conclude. He notes the case that wrapped up Tuesday took about 5 years.
If the swiftness is not there, if the people know that...
Kanyongolo says if swiftness is not there, if people know that in this system, if we go to court today, we go to court 10 years from now, it has no deterrent. Malawi has a death penalty law on the books, but there have been no executions since the country switched to a democratic government in 1994. Instead, convicted murderers remain in prison for life. Rose Msope is the project officer for NGO Human Rights for Girls and Women with Disabilities. She says in the absence of executions, the death sentence will remain useless in deterring attacks on albinos. Msope says there are times when the president pardons some of the prisoners. So should the pardon happen to those convicted for killing albinos, that means our security is still at risk. Albinos, who lack the skin pigment melanin, stands out in Africa and are targeted by so-called witch doctors who use their body parts in rituals and potions that are supposed to bring good luck. The government has tried to debunk the claims, and in June 2016, a judge issued a ban against what he called witch doctors, traditional healers, charm sellers, fortune tellers and magicians, and ads for their services. Malawi's Albino Association praised the ruling, but traditional healers said they would fight it, saying they are not involved in magic or murder. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the head of South Sudan's revenue authority says some UN agencies are not cooperating with tax laws. Find out why after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what's the most important value that your parents taught you?
They taught me to respect everyone. This makes me to live well with any person.
How to live together with people and how to prepare myself for the future. For example, I was taught how to cook by my grandmother. So I stayed with my grandmother and he taught me how to cook. So it has helped me. Because I don't always stay with my family, so that's the most important value my parents have taught me.
Being someone who might be honest in my life, even in our daily life, it's very important anyway, because in these days, many people may not be honest because of their interests.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA. South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011 and we'll get back to you. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The commissioner of South Sudan's National Revenue Authority says his agency collected $5 million and 1.5 billion South Sudanese pounds in July. Olympio Atipo says revenue collection is stabilizing because some UN agencies now pay taxes for locally hired staff. Winnie Chirino has the story for VOA from Juba.
Atipo says tax collection has steadily improved since the National Revenue Authority was established in January.
January to July, that is about 7 months. The total collection in USD is $41,953,187. That is the dollar we have collected. And the pound was $8,899,027,565. Of course, last month, July, our collection figure, the dollar, we have $5 million. And then the pounds, we have 1.514 billion. 1,500,000,000 pounds. That is the July collection. Progressively, we are improving.
Atipo says five UN agencies have submitted the names and contacts of locally hired contractors to the revenue authority who will be paying taxes.
All that we need from the agency is how to facilitate to the staff union and tell the staff that this is your obligation, this is what you're supposed to do. People have started paying. UNDP has completed all the payment. UNIDO and USAID and others, they have completed. As a matter of fact, WFP on the process, because WFP alone, within 5 years of arrears, over $700,000 to collect from staff.
Atipo is calling on other UN agencies and organizations to cooperate with the Revenue Authority and pay taxes for their contractors. He says in the past, many people thought whoever worked for a UN organization does not need to pay personal income tax. Atipo says that is wrong.
In UN, we have staff members and we have non-staff members. All service contract holders in the UN, service contract holder and office term staff are not staff members. They are under obligation to pay tax. And I want to stress, non-fixed term staff of all UN agencies under obligation to pay tax. And most of they are all national staff. So their income is not exempted from tax. But over the years, they have not been paying because on an assumption that UN staff have not paying tax.
The Tax Revenue Authority deposits the money in a secure government account, which is then turned over to the Bank of South Sudan. Abraham Kwol Nyon, Associate Professor at the University of Juba, says he agrees with the procedure that Revenue Authority is taking in keeping the money, but he disagrees with the monthly transfer of the money to the central bank. Nyon says money usually budgeted for activities have been misused by government officials. He says the money collected from non-oil revenues should be prioritized for improving schools to promote education and improving infrastructure to promote business.
The current financial crisis is showing that the government doesn't have a lot of cash or the revenue within their account. And as a result of that, for the NRA impact to be seen, they are supposed to remit that money quarterly so that they will be able to give at least good amount of money that have impact in the government spending.
Atipo says lawyers representing international NGOs have approached him on behalf of their clients to argue that international staff employed as contractors or consultants for the UN are not supposed to pay personal income tax according to the Taxation Act 2009. But he says the Taxation Act 2012 requires the international employees who are local hires in the country to pay personal income taxes. Atipo says the Revenue Authority plans to open branch offices in several states and institutions to maximize tax collection and assign additional staff to ministries and organizations to handle revenue collection. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sirino in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Khartoum, where reaction is mixed among Sudanese citizens over the U.S. decision to ban former Sudanese Chief of Intelligence Salah Ghosh and his family from traveling to the United States. Some Sudanese say the decision is long overdue because Ghosh has committed many human rights abuses, as we hear from Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Some Sudanese here say the sanction is a clear message to members of the Transitional Military Council that some members of the council have also committed atrocities against civilians since the overthrow of former President Omar al-Bashir in April. Sudanese National Hiba Fagiri praises the U.S. government for the decision. Speaking in Arabic, Fagiri believes Ghosh will be just the beginning of a long list of individuals who could face sanctions.
This is a clear message to members of the Transitional Military Council in Sudan that the American government has not forgotten the atrocities committed in June against the peaceful protesters. They want to remind them that those atrocities were a violation of human rights.
Fagiri calls Ghosh the beloved son of the U.S., but due to the recent change in the Sudanese history, the American government did not see him playing a part in the Sudan political future.
They have benefited from Ghosh as the former chief of national intelligence in Sudan, and they took the needed information on fighting terrorism in the region and the human trafficking, and he is no longer useful for them at the moment.
Hatim Dordiri, a Sudanese writer and political analyst, says the decision is long overdue. Speaking in Arabic, Dordiri insists Ghosh has committed several human rights violations which can be categorized as genocide against humanity, and says he should face the rule of law.
The Americans try to keep him as another possible choice to rule Sudan after al-Bashir, but they came and realized the zeal of the Sudanese revolutionaries and their determination for a civilian and democratic government in the country was strong, which forced the U.S. to change their minds on Ghosh.
Sudanese businessman Ali Hassan says these kind of sanctions cannot help improve the economy of the country. Speaking in Arabic, Hassan says the U.S. should focus instead on bringing to justice those who looted Sudanese wealth.
We are not going to gain anything from this sanction, because even if he has wealth, Sudanese are not going to gain anything from him. This is a political game from the American government to threaten those who are coming to rule Sudan, and they may even come and loot our resources.
Both Dirdiri and Fagiri argue that the latest sanctions should be taken seriously by the upcoming Sudanese transitional government, and it should work tirelessly towards respecting human rights in Sudan. If this happens, they say, Sudan may be removed from the list of countries that sponsor terrorism. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011 and we'll get back to you. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
And I have to repeat that number once more. Our WhatsApp number is +1 202 630 8011. We would like to hear what you think about this show, what you like about this show, and what you don't like. That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song A Call by Fally Ipupa.
The king, the genius, el professor, A Call. President des Demoniato, Yvan Joly, les boucliers, Manu des Bosquets, Picho Bongo, Soparon, Mukoka.
Listening to Fally Ipupa with the song A Call. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.